Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. Welcome to the Talky Bit. So this is part two of A Very Short History of Hell. I can say this with complete integrity, I'm pleased to say, my intentions were to do this in two parts. And I got into part two and I'm like, there's no way in wherever that we're going to get through this in two parts. we could, but it would have been an absolute gallop and a longer than typical one, but also still just a tear. Because when we start to get into, in particular, into the impact of Christian thought on this stuff in this part of the world, I mean, there's so many big ideas and so many stopping points on the journey that begin to increasingly, as we get nearer and nearer in terms of history, they begin to be more and more recognizable as the things that some of us have been taught. And so I can't do them, really do them justice, but I want to do more with them than I could legitimately do in two parts. So there will be at least a third part. I do think I can do it in three, but I don't want to make any promises that I can't end up keeping. Just want you to know my intentions are good, and they involve three parts. No, not two. Anyway,
Road I don't. The hell is paved.
Road to hell isn't. Zing! Nice one, Brett. That's going to live in my memory for a while as a great moment at the table. Remember Tim? Remember that guy whose good intentions paved the road straight to hell in six parts? Oh man, love that. Oh dear. Okay. Well, I don't want to spend a lot of time. Having said how this is expanding, I don't want to spend a lot of time on review. But I am going to recap briefly, and I'm doing that in the interest of both sort of helping us recall some of what we might have talked about previously. If this is your sort of first time checking in on the series, then also so we have some shared sense of the overall trajectory of this history, because there is. I mean, this is arguable, but I think quite convincing. Convincing argument that there is a direction in which human thought, broadly speaking, Western thought in particular about hell has traveled. There is a trajectory to this that's discernible. And I think that's important because it can help us with our own exploration in the present day to be aware of that. It can also help us to process our lived experience, I think, with a little bit more deliberateness and a little bit more awareness. Very powerful things as well. But it can also provide some hints about where things might be headed in the future. And I should say that when I chose the word hints in that sentence, I did so with real care, because predicting the future is not a game that I'm really that interested in playing. I think life has way too many variables in it for that. When I was thinking about this, I remembered Joan Didion, writer, journalist, author Joan Didion once put it this way. She wrote, "Life changes fast. Life changes in the instant you sit down to dinner, and life as you know it ends." That things just happen, don't they? We've talked about some of those together today. It's not a throwaway idea in the context of Didion's work. She is, among other things, when she writes this, she's writing as a parent who lost an adult daughter, and in particular in a book of hers called, a memoir called Blue Nights, she writes really powerfully, not just about loss, but substantially on the theme of regret in that work, her regret in particular. So for Didion, unlike Julian of Norwich, whose writing was part of our exploration in part one, for Didion, the center not only will not hold, but when she's writing at that point in her life, the center already has not held. And that's an experience, a human experience we need to keep in mind when we do work like this. It's a little too easy sometimes to zoom out and go, oh, we can just play with these. They're ideas. They are just ideas, and also ideas impact what we believe, and what we believe impacts how we act. And so, right? So this stuff has consequence. It has weight to it. So part of what I want to gesture toward but not insist on is the possibility that when we think about hell, we should keep the limitations of our ability to know things or be certain about things in view. We should hold these ideas loosely. I think there's wisdom in that. Confidence, I would say, is one thing. Certainty is quite another. And we need to keep that in mind. I want to invite us, even if this isn't hubristic, to try to equip us a bit for imagining where some of these ideas might be headed, but I think it would be overreach to say, here's what we can count on in terms of future Western thought about this. So to the review, I'll go fairly quickly through this. We started with, and I will provide pictures once again because otherwise it's all words. So we started in the ancient Near East, the Sumerians sort of representing some of the earliest societies that gathered ideas and recorded them in ways that we still have them available to us. Their idea about the afterlife was that it was a dark, dusty place, an underworld, a place of neither reward nor punishment. And in that same period of history, we find the Hebrew idea of Sheol. We'll come back to this later when we bump into sort of the Hebrew thinking as it evolves into Christian thought. But this is also a place of the dead, also, like the Sumerian idea, morally undifferentiated. It's just a place. So it's not about good and evil at this point. It's just the next place you go when you're not in this place. And then come the Egyptians and the introduction of the dead being morally measured. So that's where this starts to show up in terms of idea history. And in moral thought, Egyptian thought rather, there it's the heart that is measured, and it's measured by being weighed. It's a very material sort of thing, and it's being weighed against a standard, and the standard is pretty high. The standard is one feather taken from the wing of the goddess Ma'at. If your heart weighs more than that feather, it's annihilated by another god named Amit, which simply means the annihilator or the destroyer. And it doesn't suffer. Your heart just gets gobbled up by Amit, full stop. And then next we come to the Greeks and the Romans. I know I'm painting with just a tremendously broad brush here on all of these. So if you dive into any of these, the nuances are many and substantial. They're all interesting. But next come the Greeks and the Romans. So by now we're sort of at 800 to 200 BCE. Homer's Odyssey in particular has this idea of Hades as a bleak shadow world. And we're going to see the overlap of that with Sheol again when we come back to it. But that's followed historically by Hesiod, who evolves that idea into being a pit of punishment. So now that idea that this is a place of punishment starts to show up, as opposed to just sort of a parking lot. And in particular, in Hesiod's work, it's a place of punishment for the Titans and the worst of sinners. And so, by category, the Titans represent the sorts of people who should be somewhere suffering after they die, from Hesiod's perspective, right? And it's something that feels to me both interesting and in hindsight a bit obvious. It's the tellers of the story who get to decide who the bad guys are, right? If there's a pit of punishment, the people who should be there are clearly the Titans because they're a pain in the ass, right? Like they need to pay. So some of this stuff sort of starts to show up. And then Plato builds on this as we're now about 380 BCE with the idea that souls afterlife are either rewarded or punishment. He has a time frame for it. He says 1,000 years and then, you know, beyond that, you know, there's a little less clarity. But for 1,000 years, suffer a reward. Which brings us to the outsized influence of Zoroastrianism, 1,000 to 500 BCE. So similar time frame here as what we've already been discussing. But for the Zoroastrian thinkers, this idea of a dualistic cosmology, a world that has a good place and a bad place, is a very significant idea. So the differentiation between these two spheres in the cosmos comes into clearer view, and there's a ruling collection of deities for each. And this is also where we come across the idea that when we die, when the soul has to cross a bridge, and this bridge in Zoroastrian thought is presided over by three different deities in their thinking, and the safe passage of this, which if you get across the bridge, it means you're righteous. If you don't, it means you're not. The righteous make it across, and the wicked fall into hell. It's a really tricky bridge to cross. It keeps changing its shape. For example, so it's not easy. Which, by the way, if you're aware of Christian texts, and it's a path, not a bridge. It's a road, right? But it's narrow, and the gate's small, and it's hard to get through. So the ideas are, you can sort of see how they start to talk to one another. We left off in part one with Jewish ideas around 500 BCE to 70 CE, so crossing over the period in which Jesus of Nazareth as a rabbi, as a teacher, and a thinker in this, and in particular in that stage, the ideas of Gehenna, which is an actual valley outside of Jerusalem, infamously a site for child sacrifice and an illustration historically of the nation Israel's failure to follow their deity's directives, as well as a metaphor for divine judgment. So it's sort of, Gehenna sort of functions in more than one way in Jewish thought. And also early in this period that we're talking about here, this 500 to 70 period, there's a biblical text in Daniel that has the first mention in the biblical library of resurrection after death to either everlasting life or to shame and contempt. So that's the first place that idea that the soul lives forever in one state or the other shows up as an idea, which brings us to the early Christian period and the teachings of Jesus. Now, I should say, when Jesus does talk about things that we tend to think of now as hell, if we actually go look at them, and I think this is quite significant, but also historically a bit obvious, Jesus never teaches about hell. He never talks about hell. So that's important, isn't it, given the Christian weight given to these teachings in terms of theology and emphasis. On the two occasions where he does talk about something that tends to get treated by theologians or thinkers about being about hell, he's talking about Gehenna. That's his point of reference, and he uses it to talk about the idea of divine punishment. So that's the connection. And what I mean by a bit obvious is that these ideas about Gehenna are part of Jewish thought at this time in history. So we really shouldn't be especially surprised to find Jesus, who's a Jew, working with them. This is his context. We assemble culture out of the materials that we have on hand. This is what we do. And you may have heard me say before, my take on it is that religion is part of culture. It's a big subset, but it's part of culture making. We assemble culture out of the materials we have on hand, and when we assemble religion, we do the same thing. We make religion the same way we make other aspects of culture. So the materials that Jesus is working with include the Hebrew ideas, courtesy of Zoroastrianism, of a dualistic cosmology with divine power or powers ruling over both the good side and the bad side. And as we'll see shortly, those ideas aren't particularly nuanced at this point in history. They're not that granular, which I think is a quite reasonable explanation for why they're so general and vague in what Jesus is talking about. It's because they're general and vague in the culture at large. That's the state they're in. So that's how they get worked with. We have the unique opportunity to sort of see that looking backwards. But like the experiences we're having now, we can't know what's going to happen going forward. We're in the context we're in. If you're curious about more details, there's so much information about all of the stuff that I'm going to sum up here. But the primary stories that we have to work with in terms of Jesus teaching about this are both parables. I will talk a little bit about some contested perspectives on that, but generally speaking, both understood as parables. So in other words, they're not literal stories of history in any contemporary Western sense of the word. And they're two parables that if you grew up on Christian stories, you'll probably recognize these sort of by their titles. They're the parable of the rich man and Lazarus in Luke 16 and the parable of the sheep and goats in Matthew 25. The parable of the rich man and Lazarus, and again, parables make their points by contrasting things, by making them sort of black and white, we might say. That parable exists to illustrate the consequences, from Jesus' perspective as a rabbi, as a teacher, of prioritizing earthly wealth and neglecting the spiritual needs of others. And that there are these two distinct eternal destinies after life. All right? So that's what you see in this is a much painted parable, by the way. You start looking for art on the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, and there's just reams of, just oodles of it. I chose this one because it's a particularly... It features the binary, the either-or-ness of these two worlds, both the world of the rich man and the poor man, and of punishment and reward, are just really starkly, literally starkly drawn in this particular work. So that's why I made that choice. When Jesus tells the story, he's not talking to a big crowd. He's talking to people who are sitting consciously at his feet as a teacher. And there's also some critics in the room when he tells this story. So he's talking to his disciples, and he's talking to some Pharisees, all right? So those are sort of the two big groups, representational groups that are in the room when he tells the story. And so he tells the story of an unnamed rich man and a beggar. And the beggar has a name in the story. The beggar is Lazarus, which is why some scholars say this isn't a parable. It's actually a literal story that Jesus is aware of, because in all the other parables, when Jesus makes characters, he says, a certain man or like he doesn't name the characters, but in this one, he names Lazarus. So some people would make a great deal out of that. I'm going to treat it as a parable. In the parable, when both the characters die, the rich man goes to Hades. And here's this is interesting. Okay, so remember, Hades is a parking lot, right? Hades is not your final destiny at this point in Jewish thought. There's more to come, but there's a judgment in between. So you got to park somewhere until that happens. And so that's Hades. So the rich man goes to Hades, where he finds the beggar, whom he has shunned his whole life, ignored, put down, not cared for. He finds Lazarus, the beggar, in the bosom of Abraham, basically cradled by the patriarch. Place of safety, place of warmth, of comfort, of supply. So now the tables have turned in the parable. But he goes to Hades and he implores Abraham to send Lazarus back to the world of the living to talk to his family, the rich man's family, and go, people, if you don't take care of the poor, if you don't use your resources, if you're rich, to do some good in the world, it doesn't go well for you afterwards. So he just says, please send Lazarus back to teach them a lesson. And Abraham replies, I feel like I want to translate this and put it on a t-shirt somehow for myself, not for the rest of the world. Abraham's reply is this: if they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, so basically if they don't pay attention to the teaching they've already got, they're not going to be convinced, and this is a beauty, even if someone rises from the dead. Yeah. Yes, these things were written after Jesus' time. Anyway, in the making of a religion, right? But so there's lots going on in that little sense for sure, but it's kind of become a paradigmatic sense, right? It's like if you don't learn what's in front of you right now, you know, I don't think turning up the volume is going to help, basically. A couple of details worth noting here if we're curious about what sort of ideas were floating around in the culture in which Jesus was raised and formed his ideas. So Hades, so this parking lot that I've talked about, literally means a place or state of departed spirits. That's what Hades is. It's just, again, it's the place. And that name is borrowed from the underworld in Greek mythology, which we've already talked about a bit. And it's often strongly associated with the Jewish concept of Sheol. And I didn't really realize, I knew there was some overlap, but I didn't realize until I kind of dug into this just how much overlap there was in terms of language and ideas here. So in all but three instances, this is pretty technical, so I won't spend a bunch of time here, but it's interesting in context. In all but three instances in the oldest Greek translation of the Hebrew sacred text, so what we would think of now as the Old Testament from a Christian vantage point, in all but three instances in that, the Greek word Hades is used as the translation, direct translation for the Hebrew word Sheol. They're synonyms in neighboring languages. And personally, and I mean, you really don't need to find this interesting, but I do. In those three instances that are exceptions, the Hebrew word Sheol is translated in one instance, earth or land. So where you go after you die? Well, you go to a different land, different earth, different. And in one instance as just death, and in another instance, pit. And those are the three exceptions to it being translated as Hades. So there's a really strong, and there's hundreds of instances. So there's lots of overlap. And I don't want to get into the weeds on this, but there's some very influential early Christian thinkers who, as I mentioned, didn't regard the story as a parable. And so they make something different of this than I'm going to make of it. That parable highlights this stark contrast between the rich man's luxurious life and Lazarus's poverty, and how this disparity continues into the afterlife, but with a reversal in which the rich man suffers and Lazarus enjoys comfort. And it creates this really powerful dichotomy, like I said, which is why it ends up getting painted a lot. So we need to remember, this is the Middle Ages, all right, where this stuff really sort of comes into strong cultural view. And the majority of people who are being taught these things at this point in history are not literate. They're not looking at the texts. And so the pictures are a really big deal. They're learning from the pictures. And, I mean, this is I know we're stretching language here a little bit, but pictures are what we use to imagine things. Like that's how our image, innation. We're making pictures of things that don't exist for us materially when we imagine something. So the power of pictures as teaching tools, always, but in this period of history, they carry a lot of freight. And so if the priest says, if you do this, you're going to hell, and that's what's happening in my imagination, and this is, again, one of troves of images, that's got a lot of power to change or impact my behavior and my thought, right? So this idea that there's a place where you want to go and a place where you don't want to go as an outcome of your moral choices just really starts to balloon up at this point in history. In that second parable, which I'm not going to spend very much time on at all, the sheep and the goats, the main point is that good deeds and actions, especially helping those in need, are essential for salvation, that you end up in sort of one of two places as an outcome from how that gets judged. I'm not saying anything about the art here, except in very broad strokes, but we could lean into the art. You know, like there's lots of scholarship around what's going on inside of these paintings. So this is a major theme in the teachings of Jesus around this. When you take care of the marginalized, hungry, thirsty, strangers, naked, sick, imprisoned, that is like tending to or cultivating the good side of the divine, right? We'll talk about the good place, the TV series, in part three. But this is a cultivation of that notion that we contribute to making a good place by what we choose to do. The ideas move on in social we. So it's worth noting at this point that as far as we can tell from the stories we have, Jesus didn't come to start a religion at all. If he had any religious mission, it was the reformation of his own religion, or Judaism, which he actually criticized rather roundly as having, among other things, corrupt leadership and messed up values. He really was hard on his religion of origin, including, in terms of messed up values, losing sight of how caring for our fellow human beings is the center of what it means to act like the divine. This is how God would act if God was here. That kind of a way of thinking. And really, when we think about Christian thought, the central figure in the biblical record regarding the founding of what would become Christianity is Paul. To such a degree that one of my profs at one point suggested that the religion is misnamed. It should have been called something like Paulianity, but it doesn't exactly roll off the tongue, does it? And that's not what it ended up getting called. In any case, on the matter of the evolution of Christian ideas about hell, Paul moves the ball down the field a little bit, but his thinking about this doesn't really make any great strides. There's really not a lot of new ideas here. Essentially, what he emphasizes when he talks about this aspect of human thought is he emphasizes separation from God. But he doesn't emphasize fiery imagery. It's not about burning in a lake of fire. This comes later. It comes, but it comes later. And it's the teachers who follow Paul who really take the ball and run with it. And in particular, two thinkers, Justin Martyr and Irenaeus, second century after Christ, now CE, begin to develop these ideas of resurrection and punishment and the connection between resurrection and punishment. And they start to build on these older ideas of Hades or Sheol as somewhere where this is where the parking lot idea starts to really have some weight to it. And that way of thinking moves into the medieval period where things really start to look and sound, from our contemporary vantage point, relatively familiar. So at this point in history, so now we're like 350 to 430 CE, the main thinker and writer is Augustine of Hippo. I don't know, is this perverse? It feels a little bit perverse to me. I kind of like this particular picture of Augustine of Hippo. And I'm going to spend just a moment with the art here. For anyone who's listening to this on the podcast, I apologize that you can't see the picture. But in the top right-hand or top left-hand corner from your vantage point is this cloud of light with the word veritas in it. And veritas is the Latin word for truth. Okay, it's where we get our verily, verily from a little bit, right? So there's this light that's broadcasting truth into the world, and of course, sacred text is right there next to truth. And it comes through, like, look at where the light is around Augustine. Like, it's like a beam of light goes in one ear and comes out the other, right? We can sort of see the glow. So the truth comes to Augustine, and he explains it to us. So what he's holding in his hand is the heart, the human heart. So Augustine explains to us the truth about the condition of the human heart. And it's just like he's just a straight conduit. And the picture's terribly obvious in terms of anyway, I won't nerd out about it anymore. But it's kind of like parked right in front of you. It's like, don't you get it? The divine sent the truth to Augustine, and Augustine gave it to us, so pay attention, because veritas, this is the truth about the condition of the human heart. Now, Augustine is a guilty guy. His confessions, man, you want to read about the wrestlings of someone who can't shake loose things he did in his childhood. Like, this is Augustine, right? Like, so much unresolved guilt in this guy's life. Anyway, it does influence his thought, and his thought influenced Christianity, so that's why I mention it. But in terms of hell, in Augustine's thought, hell is punishment for... I just wish he could have been on, like, Freud's couch. Anyway, but hell is punishment for unrepented sin, right? So there's this possible salvation in here that we all need. For, from Augustine's vantage point, we arrive broken and need to be fixed in his way of thinking. He says it this way. And also, I should mention before I give you the quote, that punishment is for the first time in a broadly distributed way as a thought understood to go on forever. So it's Augustine who really kind of hammers that one home. He says it this way. This is from City of God, Book 21, Chapter 11, if you want to look it up. The penalty, therefore, so the suffering, is perpetual, that the punishment may be eternal as the guilt is eternal. My heart kind of aches for Augustine. You know, what a way to live, right? Just unresolved, endless guilt. So he's kind of a guilt specialist. And he's still in print. But he's even cheaper than Julian of Norwich. $9, or at your public library. It remains, his Confessions remains quite a popular book in context. And his emphasis is on the idea that God's justice demands eternal punishment for the sin we all inherited through original sin. So in terms of explaining the condition of the human heart from Augustine's perspective, that's how we arrive. We arrive broken and unable to save ourselves. That's our condition. And that's why, of course, in his way of thinking and in much Christian thought post-Augustine, it's God's job to fix this. It's beyond us as human beings. And it requires, and this is where we get the ancient intersecting with the contemporary in his thought in context, fixing that requires a sacrifice. It requires blood. All right. Significant intersection. Which takes us deeper into some of the emerging imagery of hell that has shaped, again, these recognizably contemporary ideas. So, the first of these that I'm going to touch on is a tradition that endured from the 5th to the 12th centuries. So can we just pause to note that this is a tradition that endured for 700 plus years? So that's by any measure, I think, that's an enduring idea. And maybe we can make sense of that when we see how picturesque it is, how much power it has as an image. Because, again, it's worth remembering that at this point in history, ideas are getting carried by imagery. This is the reason why, of course, why so many old cathedrals have great murals and altarpieces and stained glass windows. It's not just the vanity of the donors here, right? It's the people in charge kind of going, how do we convey this with some oomph? We're still doing it, of course, but now we make films, right? What this brings us to in our history trip is one of my favorite stops on the journey, honestly, something that is historically called the Harrowing of Hell. By show of hands, how many of you have ever heard of or know anything about the Harrowing of Hell? Okay. Interesting. When I start to explain it, some of you will realize you do know about it, but not by that name. Again, so many images for this. I picked a really pretty one. Okay, this is... lots of them are quite graphic and horrid. But here's what the story's about. If you grew up Christian or around that calendar, you might have noticed that there are a few days in that story between where Jesus gets crucified and where he shows up and people start seeing him again. 3 days in particular. All right? And it turns out there's quite a story about what Jesus was up to in those intervening 3 days. And the story has lots of iterations, lots of varieties, but it's all built on one very sketchy text. There's just so little, like lots of ideas that have weight, right? But there's this little text, 1 Peter 3:19, and what it says in English translation is something like, it refers to Jesus proclaiming to the spirits in prison as part of the sort of the death and resurrection narrative. That's all it says. Somewhere in this story, Jesus does this thing that the writer of 1 Peter talks about as proclaiming to the spirits in prison. Okay, so lots of interpretations available for consideration, but the one that pertains to our exploration is that in the 3 days between his death and resurrection in this story, what happened is Jesus went to hell, an actual address, in this instance, and shared the good news that because of his death, now remember how we got here, right? The sacrifice is required and so on and so forth, that because of his death, people didn't have to stay locked up there anymore. What you got to remember is that in the thought life of the day, who's there is everybody to some degree or other. This is the parking lot, all right? Because the solution to the problem, Augustine, hasn't sort of arrived yet. That's Jesus, death and resurrection, right? That's what unlocks the door. So in this story, what happens is Jesus goes down there and he tells everybody that's there what's going on. This is good news. You don't have to stay here. Now, the different iterations are fascinating because in some iterations of this, what the theologians make of this is that Jesus just basically like kicks down the door to Hades and says, it's like he bulldozed down the fence to the dog park and all the dogs can just go wherever they want, right? It's open season. Everybody's free, including all the demons. That's it. Just kind of blows the whole system up. But the more common iteration is the one you see here, which is that Jesus kicks down the door to Hades so that you're not trapped there anymore, but you have to choose. You choose to leave or stay. You can choose to stay. You don't have to come out, but you can now, right? So that's sort of how this behaves. So not in some versions, everybody gets a hall pass, and in other ones, there's a choice. Think about this story shape just for a minute. This is an archetypal hero story. If you... any war movie that you've watched where the good guys go behind the enemy lines and rescue somebody and bring them home is this story. That's the same narrative shape, right? So it's an enduring narrative shape. This is not a new idea that the good guy goes somewhere awful and brings back the people that are suffering there. And so no surprises here. This story shows up in lots of Middle Ages art and increasingly in Middle Ages theater as well. What are you going to see this weekend at MTC? Well, there's this play, actual play, called The Harrowing of Hell, and we're just going to go watch a play about what happened in those 3 days. There's lots of these, right? There's a mystery one, and I'm going to leave this with as our sort of last image. This is a line of text from this 14th century mystery play that was actually called The Harrowing of Hell. And this is the Jesus character speaking, and Adam is all humanity. Like that's what the word actually means, is a man, basically, right? A human. And so this is the Jesus character talking to all the humans, Adam. I am he that thy son is and thy brother. So I'm all things to all humans, in a sense. I'm all of these things. And by my death, I shall make thee free. So he shows up in the play at this point in the script and announces that he's here to free everyone, be they sons, brothers. They're all male, but, you know, everyone. All right? So... I'm here to free everybody that's been locked away since the time of Adam, waiting for a Messiah to arrive. So there's this intersection with the messianic stories as well. So it's the storyteller's license at work, right? And there's something kind of, for me anyway, there's something kind of both intriguing about that at a distance, and up close there's also something troubling about it because I don't think the responsibility for telling stories in a way that's helpful has gone away. We're still making stories about this stuff. And speaking of storytellers with big influence, what this brings us to in terms of the stopping points in history is this brings us to an epic storyteller, Dante, and to Dante's epic poem, Inferno. So now we're at like 1321 CE. That's Dante's chunk of history. And that is where we're going to leave it for now. I know, right? I know. You can't. You got to leave it at a place where something's still going to happen. Otherwise, I'll be talking to myself next time in part three. Anyway, so that's where we're going to leave it. Because the influence of Dante's work on our contemporary images of hell is enormous. Basically, he drew the picture that we're still painting in terms of our contemporary ideas about hell in lots of ways. So we'll give that a bit more consideration. When I got to Dante, that's where I realized there is no way this is fitting into two parts. So we're going to stop right there, and we'll come back to it in part three. But I'm going to leave you with a line from from line 9 from Canto 3 in Inferno, which you'll recognize probably. It says, "Abandon all hope, ye who enter here." So for Dante, depending which circle you're in, that might be the last word, right? No doors getting kicked down for you. But we'll unpack that another time. As with part one, I find myself feeling a little uncomfortable wishing you all peace, but also hopeful. And so I offer you that at the end of this. Remember where we started in terms of our exercise. And again, if you're listening to this on the podcast, you won't have been part of the exercise. But what we did together in the room is we breathed in the idea that it's okay, and we breathed out the idea that it's okay to change what we believe. And okay is, I would say, a good starting place. More safe than less safe, and all those things that really matter in that regard. But also, you wouldn't have to stop at okay. Yes, it's okay to change what we believe, but also, it's exciting to change what we believe. There's hope that lives in that idea. There's newness. There's renewal. There's regeneration. There's growth. The best sorts of images of change that I think can live in an idea like it's okay to change what you believe. So in that space, I wish you peace as you think about these things and also as you and we all live with the things that challenge us, including the things that challenge us about what we can't see, which is all the stuff over the horizon, right? Which is why we're making stories about this in the first place. When we think about what's next, that matters to us. And so I hope we can think about that with less distress maybe and more hope and more peace, given some of the things that we're able to see about human thought about this historically. All right. Peace, period.